My condition, it just keeps getting worse and worse.
For sufferers of minor or acute condition, life can be difficult.
You're telling me.
But new clinically proven Crumbandola can relieve the worst symptoms of condition.
You mean there's something that can help? Thank God.
So talk to your doctor about Crumbandola.
My doctor? Yeah, I don't have one of those.
Side effects may be severe. So tell your doctor if you have signs of dementia.
Okay.
Unusual growth.
Yeah, but...
Trouble breathing. Teeth.
Okay,
or stigmata.
I don't have a doctor. I don't know anyone who has a doctor. I've tried to find a doctor.
Condition is bad.
Yes.
But Crumbandola can help.
I'm sure it can.
Tell your doctor today.
But I don't have a doctor.
Crumbandola is not a real drug, and that was a fake ad. But have you heard about how America is running low on doctors and how all sorts of players are stepping in to tend to patients, like CVS, surely, but also Walmart, which I guess kind of makes sense, but Dollar General, really, and Best Buy, where I used to buy System of a Down CDs? That's all ahead on Today Explained. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Noelle. Before the show starts, I want to invite you to take a survey that we're running right now. If you have a few minutes, we would appreciate you going to vox.com/podcast survey and telling us what you think. vox.com/podcast survey. There's also a link in the show notes. This will really help the show out, so thank you.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Today Explained, Sean Ramos firm. I mostly try to avoid doctors, had a bad experience, but I recently tried to get my once-a-decade checkup, and getting an appointment with a new physician was tough. It was like trying to get into New York's hottest club, tough. Dylan Scott covers healthcare at Vox, and he's been having a tough time too.
Yeah. I mean, your story is not unique, I am sad to say. My family has gone through the exact same thing. My wife in particular has been trying to find a new primary care doctor for like the last year. And first of all, there just weren't that many who were accepting new patients. And second of all, once she did actually have an appointment scheduled, it ended up getting canceled and she had to kind of start from scratch.
And it's not just Dylan and me in and around D.C. We asked you about your experiences, and they reflected ours.
Yeah, my name is Mindy, and I'm from Arvada, Colorado. Both my wife and I, we just really can't find a primary care at all.
My name is Macy. I live in Columbus, Ohio. I knew I was turning 26 and was going to lose health insurance from my parents. So 6 months in advance, I started to make all of my like preventative and annual appointments. A lot of offices in the Columbus area were full up to 9 to 12 months. So I was not able to get into a lot of my appointments prior to losing insurance. And, you know, that's just preventative and annual stuff.
And if we take a look at the data, like, those kinds of experiences are not that unusual. The number of Americans who say that their primary source of medical care is actually like a personal physician, one person that they go back to again and again, those numbers have been declining. And especially for younger patients, about half of people under 30 say they do not have a primary care doctor. About 1 in 4 people say they don't have any regular source of healthcare in the United States. And that number has been growing. Primary care, what was once kind of the foundation of American medicine and of, you know, people's relationship to the healthcare system, has really been getting squeezed for decades now. And I think patients especially are starting to feel that squeeze.
We asked Dylan what primary care looked like back when it was the foundation of American medicine.
If you lived in a small town, there was a primary care doctor, and they ran their own practice. They were in charge. They employed themselves. You'd go see them for your checkups, for sick visits. If you went to the hospital, they'd probably go to the hospital with you and admit you and oversee your care there. That's when the family doctor, the primary care doctor, had this place of primacy in the American healthcare system.
And when does it start to go south?
In the early 80s. Some important things started to change with like the overall healthcare system around that time. Some of the big ones are, you know, hospital systems were growing. They were looking for new revenue opportunities. And so they identified like, all right, we're providing all this inpatient care, performing surgeries, delivering babies, fixing broken bones, whatever. But like, you know, there's this whole other swath of the healthcare industry, primary care, you know, outpatient visits, where there's even more money to be made. Like back, you know, 30, 40 years ago, most doctors were self-employed. Like something like 3/4 of doctors were running their own business. They were entrepreneurs as much as physicians. But these days, and just in the last couple years, we've reached a milestone where like actually most doctors and most primary care doctors are now employed by somebody else. They work for a hospital or, you know, maybe a larger system of clinics, what have you. But that's been a real change. We've gone from the sort of like, you know, the independent doctor to primary care doctors who are now just kind of cogs in the system. And I think that has led to, you know, less of a personal relationship between patients and their doctors. And I know that doctors in the field are really concerned about that.
Hi, this is Pamela Root. And I'm calling from Vermont, and I work with a lot of elderly people who have had unbelievable problems with trying to get things resolved with doctors and appointments. And it just seems that privatized, these big investment companies that own all these hospitals and medical facilities, they would rather not deal with doctors.
Why does this consolidation, though, lead to the shortage that you're describing?
It's a combination of a few different things. It is partly a consolidation, like health systems absorb these primary care practices. And, you know, their directive to the doctors is like, you need to see as many patients as possible. And so that gives, you know, because the way primary care doctors are paid or their health systems are paid for their services is, you know, largely fee for service. Like you have an appointment, you order a test, volume is king. You need to be doing as many different services as possible.
Hello, my name is Debbie Kennedy, calling you from Salem, Oregon, which is a medical wasteland. It's become universal throughout the city here to just give people 15 minutes of your time if they have an appointment with you. And that's not their fault. That's the fault of whoever's running the clinic.
Obviously, from a hospital's perspective, they want to bring in money, but they also want to minimize their overhead. So they're going to only hire as many primary care doctors, you know, as they think is worth their while, but not more. And because, you know, hospital systems are often so dominant in their local healthcare markets, that can make it a lot harder for another doctor to set up an independent practice.
Hello, my name is Soraya. I'm from Houston, Texas. We also are suffering the healthcare shortage. Essentially, we have hospitals where people are jumping from hospital to hospital depending on who is offering the bonus, but we just don't have enough providers to fill all of the positions.
The other part of it that I think is really important is like from a medical training perspective and from an economic perspective, you can make a lot more money if you train to be an orthopedic surgeon or do some kind of other medical specialization. You potentially could make like twice as much money. We have this system of medical training where Medicare is responsible for setting up residency programs so that doctors in training can actually practice in the field for a few years after medical school. And the number of slots that are devoted to primary care has not been sufficient for a long time, according to people who look at these workforce issues. So we're both not like creating enough primary care doctors, you know, in our medical training pipeline. We're not giving, you know, aspiring doctors much of a financial incentive to practice primary care. And we've just made the prospect of entering primary care, you know, in terms of your work experience, less appealing because now you're just going to be, like I said before, a cog in a larger hospital's machine. Like that's why we're seeing these dwindling number of people who are entering the primary care space.
Yeah, this is Daniel Blakely, and I was hospitalized randomly for a hiking incident And when I got out of the hospital, I was directed by the emergency room doctors to contact my primary to figure out my recovery. When I got home, things did not get better. They actually got worse, and I kept trying to call my primary. He never called me back, not once. And it's kind of indicative of the healthcare in San Luis Obispo, which is considered a rural area, so it doesn't attract doctors. I had to wait almost a year to get my first visit with this doctor, and now I'm having to wait almost the same time to switch doctors because I just can't trust this original doctor anymore.
Where is this doctor shortage felt most profoundly?
Rural areas in particular experience the worst shortages. And that's, you know, it does go back right there to the economics. On top of that, you know, there are like other considerations when people are trying to decide where to work, right? Like, it's not just about like, you know, where's there a job? It's like, what kind of community do I want to live in? Where might there be a job for my partner? That kind of thing. And that continues to tug more and more doctors towards large population areas. But if you kind of take a big step back, it's not totally clear whether we don't have enough doctors, like, overall.
Oh?
The issue is less that, like, we have an overall doctor shortage, and more that the doctors we have are not very well distributed. We might, in theory, have enough doctors.
What about the patients, Dylan? We've been talking about doctors, hospitals, the industry, but what about patient behavior? Has that changed in a way that affects this shortage or affects the ability for patients to find doctors in any meaningful way?
It does seem that what has changed is patients' expectations about how quickly they should be able to access a doctor.
Hi, this is Jessica Starr. I'm calling from Springfield, Massachusetts. Finding a doctor has been insane. I couldn't find anybody who could take me in less than 6 months. Now, I was able to resolve this by moving to a telemedicine doctor's office. So now I have an app on my phone and a doctor that I can just send a message to at any point, which is really great, but it also is kind of missing that in-person touch.
And so there's this, you know, kind of industry of alternative options that has started to proliferate. Like, we've seen an explosion in the number of urgent care clinics in the United States.
Mm.
You've seen pharmacies like CVS and Walgreens start to set up clinics in their stores where people can get at least like very basic healthcare services and even get, you know, a physical, get some of their vitals checked, that kind of thing. And we're seeing other companies start to explore this space. Like, you know, Walmart has pledged to double its healthcare footprint. It's become clear that sort of the traditional model of primary care is broken, in part because of issues on the supply side that we've already talked about, but also because of, you know, the demand side and consumers' expectations about being able to see their doctor whenever they want to see their doctor. And so we're seeing these competitors pop up, and it's you know, led to this kind of inflection point for primary care going forward.
Whether big box entering big medicine is a good thing for little patient, when we're back on Today Explained.
Support for Today Explained comes from Mint Mobile. Sometimes you see a really good sale, a really good deal, and you think, huh, what's the catch? You may be used to seeing quote-unquote great deals from overpriced wireless providers and thinking, what's the catch? With Mint Mobile, they say, there is no catch. For a limited time, their wireless plans are just $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. To get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/explained. That's mintmobile.com/explained. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/explained. $45 upfront payment is required. That's equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 GB on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Hey.
Support for Che Explained comes from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. If you like spy thrillers or indeed Elizabeth Moss, then you might want to check out FX's The Veil. It's an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. Oh, I'll go. One woman has a secret, same here, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu.
Okay, Today Explained is back with Dylan Scott from Vox. Dylan, you said that big pharmacy, the Walgreens, the CVSs, were part of the reason that patients are losing their patients, but also maybe part of the reason that it's getting hard to find a doctor. But I just recently read that Rite Aid, one of these big pharmacy outfits, is in financial straits.
One of the country's largest pharmacy chains, Rite Aid, has filed for bankruptcy protection.
What gives?
Well, I think the Rite Aid situation, it's unique. The reasons that Rite Aid is citing for preparing for bankruptcy is that, like, it has some longstanding debt. It also has some financial obligations as a result of some of the opioid epidemic settlements that have been made with state and federal governments over the years, here in recent years.
Fair.
So I do think that, like, it's not necessarily, like, a sign that this business model is going under. I think it's still important for the subject that we've been discussing because, like, these clinics, these minute clinics that are, they're largely run out of these big pharmacy chains. For some people, especially for people who, generally speaking, don't have a lot of healthcare access, like, that might be the most obvious place for you to go to get basic medical checkups, to get your vaccines. Even if these kinds of minute clinics aren't a perfect replacement for, like, a personal physician, they do provide healthcare for a lot of people, particularly people who might not have access to other kinds of healthcare.
If a Rite Aid goes under, which is happening, who steps in? Is it just CVS or Walgreens? Because I've heard, like, at least CVS is shutting down stores all over the place, too.
Yeah, you're right.
The nation's largest pharmacy chain is now planning to close as many as 900 stores over the next 3 years. That's about one-tenth of its locations.
Walgreens has said the same thing.
It comes after they failed to meet earnings expectations and lost about 59% this year in reported net income.
I think some of that is linked more to just, like, the general struggle of brick and mortar retail right now. And part of the reason I think that is that we do see other chains still interested in getting into the healthcare game. I think, you know, the most striking example has been Dollar General.
Dollar General, the known dollar store?
The dollar store where you're supposed to be able to, you know, go pick up, like, your household cleaning supplies for a couple bucks or whatever, you know, yeah.
Hi, besties. We are sitting outside of the Dollar General, and I'm about to take you in-store and show you some deals that you can do utilizing this coupon right here, the 5 off 25 Saturday only coupon.
They've become kind of omnipresent across the country, again, particularly in neighborhoods and communities where there might not be a lot of other just shopping retail options. And so they have identified, you know, healthcare as a potential opportunity for expanding their business.
So can you get, like, a colonoscopy for, like, a couple bucks?
We're not there yet. You know, they've been taking baby steps. So, like, first they hired a chief medical officer a couple of years ago and announced they were creating, like, a healthcare advisory board to kind of figure out, like, what would a Dollar General but for healthcare look like?
Huh.
And so they've been slowly ramping up over the last couple of years. Like, for one, they've just started to stock healthcare products in their stores. And then earlier this year, they started piloting, like, mobile clinics that would be held, you know, at the locations of their retail stores. So they've set up these, like, trailers. They've partnered with a group called DocGo, which is, like, you know, its whole business is providing mobile health and transportation services. And so in Tennessee, they had set up a handful of these, like, mobile clinics to do a lot of the same stuff that, you know, Walgreens and CVS have been doing at their minute clinics, you know, physicals, routine checkups, vaccinations, lab testing, even diagnostics, like an EKG. If somebody comes in complaining about their heart, they can do certain urgent care services, like, you know, treating wounds, and even help, you know, people who have, like, high blood pressure, diabetes, you know, get their vitals checked and potentially get prescribed any medication that they might need. So I do think that that suggests that, like, yes, while those marquee pharmacy chains have had some business struggles here of late, there are still other franchises that see a real opportunity in providing this basic kind of medical care to people, particularly people who might not have a personal physician and who are just looking for some kind of option to get their basic medical needs met.
I've seen a pharmacy at the Walmart. Dollar General is getting in the mix. How long is it until, like, Best Buy and TJ Maxx are getting in on the action?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because Best Buy has begun talking about offering telemedicine services. I mean, that's another potential opportunity here. Like, that's another way in which primary care may begin to evolve. Maybe you don't have, like, a doctor's office or even a pharmacy nearby, but, like, most people can hop on their phone or hop on a computer and talk to people that way. You know, then this is happening across different practices, not just in terms of what Best Buy is trying to do. Like, I'll make a confession here, Sean.
Okay.
I got my physical.
At Best Buy?
Not at Best Buy. At a normal doctor at a big hospital system, you know, totally part of all the trends that we were talking about in our earlier segment. But, like, my blood pressure was a little high. And so, like, they wanted me to start monitoring it. And I was able to get, like, this blood pressure monitor for my house that, like, puts all the information onto my phone, and then I can just send that as a digital message to my doctor, like, without ever going in to see him.
Huh.
And this is another way that, like, you know, physicians are trying to make everything more convenient for their patients, because, like we said, patients don't have the patience to wait to be seen by a doctor like they used to.
Yeah.
And that's where I think these other companies like Best Buy, they're like, we have the entire infrastructure to do this kind of stuff. So, like, maybe this is a way that we can get a piece of the big healthcare pie that's an enormous part of our economy. So at least they're having some kind of contact with the healthcare system rather than being cut out entirely.
Is there, like, a 1% equivalent to what's going on the more middle class end of the spectrum here? With, like, if Best Buy's getting in and Dollar General's getting in, is, like, Louis V going to get in or something to provide healthcare services? What's the 1% doing?
Well, I do think some of these, like, concierge clinics, like One Medical, which Amazon acquired a couple of years ago, like, I think those are a good example of what kind of the high class version of this looks like. You know, you have this clinic that's your home base. You pay, you know, a monthly or annual retainer to be, like, on their patient roster. Basically, what that retainer is supposed to give you is pretty much direct access to your doctor whenever you want it. And that can either be, like, you come in for checkups or maybe for an acute medical visit. You know, it should be really quick, really easy to get an appointment. Or you might, like, have your doctor's phone number and you can, like, text them if you've got a question. Or you've got one of these messaging portals, and there's sort of an understanding that because you pay basically to be a member of this clinic, that you're going to get really, really quick access. That's, I think, what kind of the higher class version of this it looks like. You know, a similar but distinct model is known as direct primary care. And it works on a similar business model where it's like you pay, you know, a monthly or annual fee to be a part of this practice. And what that fee is supposed to get you is that direct access to your doctor whenever you want it, that kind of convenience that patients, I think, feel like they've been losing from their more conventional primary care physician.
How should we feel about it, Dylan? I mean, it's easy to scoff at, like, the dollar store getting involved in healthcare, or maybe it's a bit of a head scratcher to hear that, like, Best Buy wants to provide you with, you know, blood pressure checkups or whatever it might be. But is this ultimately a good thing that these big box stores and chains want to step in and provide healthcare in a country that apparently has a bit of a shortage?
This is an all-hands-on-deck situation. Fewer and fewer Americans have our usual source of healthcare, go and see a doctor on an annual basis. That's how we catch things early. That's how we get ahead of things. And if we get ahead of things, that tends to lead to better healthcare outcomes down the road. And so, like, while I do think something is lost when you don't have that personal relationship with an individual doctor, I still think it's better for people to have, you know, a clinic at their local pharmacy or to be able to go to Dollar General. And it's clearly a net good for healthcare access in a general way, that people now have these options available to them. I think the question right now is, do these sort of alternative models for providing primary care for people, can they do at least a good enough job of approximating what people would get from a more conventional primary care doctor, that we're at least, you know, addressing their healthcare needs and help preventing worse outcomes down the road? But I think if we want to look at the long term, how do we kind of create a primary care workforce that's big enough, that's robust enough for our country, that is able to engage with people as they want to be engaged with, we got to look at training, we got to look at how we pay doctors, and we got to look at how we finance the hospital systems that increasingly employ our primary care doctors.
Dylan Scott, senior healthcare correspondent at Vox. His one about all this is called What Happened to the Family Doctor? Find it at Vox.com. Our program today was produced by John Ahrens. We were edited by Amina Al-Sadi, fact-checked by Laura Bullard, and mixed by Patty Boyd. The rest of the team includes Victoria Chamberlain, Siona Petros, Halima Shah, Avishai Artsy, Hadi Mawagdi, Amanda Llewellyn, Isabel Angel, Rob Byers, our managing editor Matthew Collette, our executive producer Miranda Kennedy, and our co-host Noel King. Congratulations to Miles Bryan. Our condolences to Philadelphia. We use music by Breakmaster Cylinder, and today we used a lot of music by John Ahrens. Today Explained is distributed by WNYC. The show is a part of Vox, which is totally free, thanks in part to contributions from our listeners. Join us at vox.com/give. Thank you.